Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Kay Puttock, together with my co-host, Roxanne Thompson.
Hello, Kay, and hello to you, the listener. Today our program focuses on children and working families. Later in today's program, we'll follow up with the second segment on foster children, a topic we introduced on Local Talk earlier this month, appropriately enough, since May is Foster Care Month.
And today we'll also have a summary from Local Talk reporter Greta Anderson about the Working Families Summit that took place this past weekend. And we bring Ames Director of Planning and Housing, Kelly Diekman, into the studio to discuss the development on the lot opposite City Hall on 6th Street. This is the area where the City Council has approved the construction of a low-income housing complex.
But right now we have Tim Wilson in the studio. Tim is statewide administrator of the Lions Club, who has a busy week ahead of him preparing for the Lions Eyesight event at the Special Olympics.
Welcome, Tim.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thanks, Roxanne, and thank you, Tim Wilson, for coming in. Many of us associate the Lions Club with a collection of old pairs of eyeglasses.
Mm-hmm.
The Lions, a fraternal organization, which welcomes women, by the way, has had a long history of service in the area of eyesight. Those of us in the developed world who have middle-class incomes might not think twice about seeing an eye doctor to get corrective lenses, but for most of the world's population, it's a lot harder. The Iowa Lions Club is focusing on a very special population this weekend. In fact, it's the participants in the Special Olympics with a program called Opening Eyes. Tim, can you tell us what this program is all about?
Sure. First, for those of you who don't know why Lions or how Lions got involved with eyesight, 1925, Helen Keller stood in front of our international convention in Cedar Point, Ohio, and encouraged us or challenged us to be Knights of the Blind. So ever since then, that's where we've helped people with the eyeglasses and stuff like that. Back in 2001, 2002, our international foundation, Lions Clubs International Foundation, or LCIF we call, they teamed up with Special Olympics and donated money to get this program, Opening Eyes, started. And it's a great program all around the world because we are a global organization. The Lions come together at Special Olympics events and screen the eyes of the athletes. And that screening runs the whole gamut from color blindness to all the way to where we have doctors, eye doctors there with the testing machines to see what kind of prescription the athlete may need.
Are people in Special Olympics, that is to say people with cognitive disabilities, are they more likely to have eye problems?
Yes. I have a personal interest in Special Olympics because I have a niece who's Down syndrome and she competes every year. She's a very gifted young lady. And yes, they do have issues and problems with their eyesight. A lot of them, they can't verbalize if they do have a problem,
yes.
like small children. They can't verbalize it. So the doctors and the people that come and help us with our event are tremendous. In fact, that's one of my Lions moments I had was the first year we were doing it. There was a young boy, an athlete getting his eye screened by the eye doctor and the mother came up to me and said, this is a great program because our local eye doctor can't handle him.
Oh.
And she said, he's sitting there perfect for him. And he walked out of there with a new pair of glasses. That's a great thing. Every one of those athletes that comes in there gets a new pair of glasses, if they need it or not, because they give away free sunglasses. And those athletes love the free sunglasses too. So, yeah, I mean, it's a great thing. We have a doctor from Red Oak who sort of takes control of the program and lines up all the doctors. And then we have a gal who coordinates all the volunteers, and that's great. We're always looking for volunteers to come and help, and it's going to be this Friday, May 22nd. They set up at, I can't remember, I think at the Fortner Women's Studies Building. Mm-hmm. It's just west of the lead rec center where most of the activity, the Special Olympics activity is going. They set up in the gymnasium in that building. And like I said, we bring the athletes come in. We start them off just with basic screenings, and then they go to the eye test and then all the way to the doctors. So it's a great program. And like I said, if you can come out, not even just to volunteer, just to see what's going on, because it's great to interact with those athletes, and it's great to see them excited about, you know, they can get glasses if they need it.
That's very interesting. Like a connection with Helen Keller. I didn't know that. It's
yep.
very interesting.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things you do, our Lions Club does, is collect eyeglasses.
Yes, we do.
And now you mentioned giving away free sunglasses to people that don't need eyeglasses, but I'm, and probably a lot of other people, a little puzzled by this collecting eyeglasses. How do you reuse these? And how about the correct prescription for the individual and so on?
That's a very good question, because we do collect eyeglasses. And if you're in the Ames area, you can bring them to our state office, or most Walmarts will have a collection bin, or, you know, some grocery stores do. You can always call us. I know in Des Moines there's probably 6 or 7 different eyeglass collection areas, like the East Des Moines Library and stuff like that. Or your local optometrist. Mm-hmm. A lot of times they'll collect them and then they'll give us a call.
Now, these would be glasses that people have discarded because they've got a new
right.
prescription.
You would be surprised. I mean, there's some you know, vintage glasses, shall we say, that come into the office. But what they do, they take them. We have a few clubs that come to the state office and pick them up, and then they'll go and screen them, you know, or test them with the machine to see what the prescription is, and sort them to the per prescription and package them. Then they usually go to somebody, usually over in Iowa City, doctors that take trips to other countries.
Oh.
Because it is illegal in the United States to give away used eyeglasses. Simply because of the fact that what you brought up, the prescription, with the Sioux mentality mostly of people in this country, you give a person a pair of eyeglasses that's close to their prescription, then they go and have a car accident, and then they can blame you for giving you a
If people have their eyes tested on different days, they often come out with a different prescription.
Exactly. But that's why it is illegal in this country to give somebody used eyeglasses. So all of the eyeglasses that we collect go to different countries. And, you know, one of the stories I've heard is a gal was getting her eye screened and they put a pair of glasses on her and she bolted out the door. And the doctor's like, what's going on? And somebody who's standing there says, she's never been able to see her kids.
Oh.
So when they put those eyeglasses on her, she could see, and she bolted out there to go see her kids. And that's one of the stories. Another one of these stories that you hear is a lion. So that's what happens to the used eyeglasses.
So she was so excited.
She was so excited. But we do offer, a lot of the Lions clubs offer a program to get new glasses for people. So if you call us up, depending on where you live, we can contact you with the local Lions Club, and most Lions Clubs have a program where they deal with a local optometrist and they can get you.
So you're talking now not people, for example, participants in Special Olympics, but anyone.
No. Correct. That is, I mean, anybody that can't afford new eyeglasses.
Anyone that cannot afford them. Well, that's very useful.
You know, and now, we see a lot of that. I get, in our state office, I get at least 4 calls a week for people that need new eyeglasses.
Hmm. Yeah, because they can be very expensive, especially when you need bifocals and all that.
Exactly.
Kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we also have a hearing aid program too.
Oh, okay.
Where we collect used hearing aids, and we have a hearing aid bank.
Now, are there laws about distributing those in this country, hearing
aids? No, there is no other laws about that I'm aware of, but our hearing aid bank's been in existence for 30 years, and it's, we get the used hearing aids, and Starkey, it's a hearing aid company, they'll check them out and refurbish anyone, and the ones that can be used go to our hearing aid bank, and then, clubs, you fill out a form, and then usually the club will pay for the doctor's appointment and the molds, which runs, I've been told, about $100 to $200. And then they get hearing aids for free, which I've been told brand new hearing aids that run anywhere from $7,000 to $10,000.
Yeah,
so it's a great program for people, that the older people that can't can't afford them. So.
Okay. Well, that's worth knowing about. Another program I believe that the Lions are responsible for is a special student exchange program that will be taking place this summer. Can you tell us about that?
Correct. Our Iowa Lions Youth Exchange, it's an international program through Lions. Just like, you know, other service organizations have their youth exchange, and this is Lions. And what happens is we bring students in for about 3 to 4 weeks, starting the end of June. And they'll, you know, we get, families that want to take the time to host them. And I believe we're still looking for, we still need about 6 families to host a youth. If anybody's interested, they can get a hold of me at the state office. But part of that 3 weeks is 1 week we bring them all in to a camp. And this year we're going to be at Camp Hanashaw right south of Boone. And we were there last year and we're going to be back there again this year. And we do activities in camp and outside of camp, you know, take them to Des Moines, to Adventureland, and come to Ames and do different activities, go roller skating, stuff like that. And a lot of stuff that they wouldn't experience in their own.
So what countries do they come from?
They come from all over, from Great Britain, Norway, Finland, Sweden, Russia. We've had some, from Russia, Germany, Turkey, Israel.
Really all over.
Yeah, all over.
But it's a long way to come for just 3 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks.
Well, they have great time. And a lot of these students, this isn't just the only youth exchange they go on. A lot of them have either been on another exchange mm-hmm. to this country or to other countries. I know a girl from Italy that was here has been to South America on an exchange also. Because, okay. You know, with Facebook and that, we all become Facebook friends and we see what they're doing sure. after camp. But, yeah, they go all over.
Hosted by local families.
They're hosted by local families.
But their activities during the day is taken care of by the Lions.
When they're at camp.
Oh, okay.
When they're not at camp, the host family takes care sure. of, you know, shows them, go take some shopping. You wouldn't believe all these kids that come in and they want to go shopping.
Oh, yeah.
Because they want to buy stuff for their family members, take home sure, and stuff sure. like that. So, you know, they take them shopping or they take them to their, you know, in Iowa, almost every town has a yearly celebration. So they'll take them that. And a lot of them come in for the 4th of July, too. So they'll take them to 4th of July celebrations and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So they have a great time. They love being here. We get a lot of kids currently or this year we're going to have, I believe, 22 kids from 19 different countries.
Wow.
And then we usually bring in some Iowa youth, too, to be Iowa host youth, we call. And this year, we're going to bring in some Leo clubs because we have – or Leo club members. We have Leo clubs that are for high school age and middle school age kids. So they'll be coming in to help.
And you say you need more host families?
Yes. We're always looking for host families, and I believe we're still looking for about six or seven host families before the end of June.
Could you give us a phone number that people could call?
Sure. They can call me at – it's area code 515-232-2215. That's the Iowa Lions State Office here in Ames.
Okay. So I'll repeat that. This is the number to call if you're willing to at least look into the possibility of being a host family for these kids on their international exchange. 515-232-2215. And they can look you up on your website.
Yes, we do have a website. It's iowalions.org. Mm-hmm. And our email is iowalions@aol.com.
Okay.
So either one of those can get a hold
of me. Okay, we'll put that on our website too. So.
All right, good deal.
Okay, well, those sound like two very worthwhile programs. Are there any other events or programs that you've got coming up?
Oh, we always have great programs coming up. One that we're really promoting right now, we're starting to promote, is back in 2012, the Iowa Lions and the Iowa Lions Foundation, our foundation, helped sponsor the National Beat Baseball Association World Series. And this is it's a beat baseball game, or it's a baseball game for blind people, where the ball, I should have brought a ball in with me, it was like a softball sized ball and you pull a pin and it beeps. Then there's two bases that also beep at different tones so they'll know where to run. And like I said, in 2012, we hosted the World Series. And then it's coming back next year. It'll be next July 24th through the 30th of 2016. And we're always looking for volunteers. If you want to volunteer for that, get a hold of me at the state office. Or if you want to donate money, we have sponsorships that if you work for a company that might be willing to be a sponsor, or you can adopt a beat baseball for $100. You can adopt one of those balls that will be used during the tournament, and you have the option of getting that ball back after the tournament if you would like. If not, then they just give it to the Beat Baseball Association.
What a deal.
For $100, you can have a ball out there that they'll be using. And I haven't seen it played. I wasn't around in 2012 in Iowa when it was here, but these teams get competitive. That's what I've been, they are very competitive, and it's a pretty rough tournament, they say, but everyone has fun, and it's great for these. I've talked to a gentleman from the National Beat Baseball Association, and he says some of these kids and people that are blind that are just shy when they start playing beat baseball, they're just a whole different person. Mm-hmm. They've come out of their shell and that. And we do have a beat baseball team here in Iowa, based out of Waukee, called the Iowa Reapers. And they go around and do, so if you want them, they'll do a demo. If you can get a group of people that want to play with them, they'll blindfold you, and you can go in there and try to hit that ball if you'd like or field it too. So, let us know. Just call the state office. So that's one of them. We always have stuff going on. We have our kids sight program where we screen kids' eyes from 6 months to 6 years old. We found that if a child has a vision problem, if you catch it early enough, you can change it or you can fix it before it becomes permanent, because after age 7 to 9, your eyesight becomes permanent. And kids that are 6 months old, they can't verbalize. Right. If they have a sight issue. Mm-hmm. So what we do, we have a digital camera. They're special digital cameras, and they'll take two photos at the same time, simultaneously, at different perspectives. And then those get sent to Iowa City, the ophthalmology department there, and they'll read them just by looking at the photo. They can see if they have a problem. One of the main problems we find is amblyopia, and that can be corrected.
What
usually
is that?
I don't know all the technicalities of the disease, but I know it can be treated by wearing patches over your good eye and
sort of training one eye.
So if it's in one eye, you can sort of train that eye to catch up with the good eye. So, and it's great to hear these parents of these children that their eyesight has been saved by
I think I have that. In fact, I know I do. One of my eyes is much worse than the other.
Yes.
It's been since the time I was.
And one club I was visiting, they had a thank you note from a mother that had twin daughters, and one of them really wasn't, doing a lot of activities, but she said they found a problem with her eyesight. It's been corrected. And she said, you can't get her away from the coloring book enough. Right. And she's talking more. She's doing a lot more. She's much more active. So it's great when you hear those kinds of stories we're making a difference just by taking a photo of their eyes. But those are the main ones. But we have a whole bunch. If anybody wants any more information, they can go on our website, iowalions.org, or call me at the office or email me. I'm there 5 days a week. So.
Okay. I'll give that phone number one more time. That's 515-232-2215, and that's Tim Wilson's number. You'll get him there. Well, thank you very much, Tim, for telling us about all these wonderful programs.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're following up with Helen Keller's admonition.
Yes.
There you go.
That's wonderful.
And a lot of people don't realize that, but that's how we all got started. That's how Lions got started.
That's an inspiring story.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So, and I love talking about Lions.
Okay.
So.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Our program today explores various issues concerning children, disadvantaged people, including working families. We've just heard about Opening Eyes, a program at the Lions Club, which provides eye care and eyeglasses for participants in the Special Olympics. And continuing on the subject of children and their needs, today we're going to hear a bit more about a topic we began earlier this month, the topic of foster care and the needs of foster families. In a minute or two, we're going to hear an interview with two young sisters who've been in foster care, though they've now been adopted. But first of all, Roxanne, who's my co-host today, I'd like to hear from you. I asked you to co-host this show with me because you've had an impressive history of a career in areas of social work, particularly with children and their needs. Would you give us some idea of your background in this area and what you've learned from it?
Sure, I'd be very happy to, Kay. I did work for 35 years for the Iowa Department of Human Services, or DHS, and it was in the child welfare area of that agency. My career started up in northern Iowa. Our family moved to Ames in 1992, where I continued with the Department of Human Services, at that time in administrative capacity. First as a county director for Story County, and then I became an area administrator for 12 counties in and around Story. And I retired from the department in 2010. I'm happy to say that since my retirement, I've become employed part-time with Youth and Shelter Services. I work with a program called Achieving Maximum Potential, or AMP. We work with youth 13 and older to help prepare them for a successful adulthood. These youth are in some type of out-of-home placement, either foster care, living with a relative, or have been adopted. Why I'm so appreciative of all of our community agencies is that in working for the Department of Human Services, my job was to focus on child safety and well-being. The department is responsible to complete child abuse and neglect assessments with the ultimate goal of assuring that kids are safe with their families. Following a assessment of abuse or neglect, we determine whether the child or children were abused and their basic needs were not met, putting their safety at risk, and then we have to determine if the child can continue to reside with the family. If we decide that the child can be safe residing with the family, then generally we turn to our community agencies and supports to provide what the family needs so that the kids can stay there. At the same time, if we determine that a child cannot be safe temporarily in the parental home, then we move them into an out-of-home placement, and again, relatives if possible, but if that's not possible, then we look to a foster home, which is, again, a community need that is so well met in our area. This is a temporary placement until the parents can meet their needs, and the goal is always reunification. If we determine that the parents can't meet the children's need, then we need to look for a permanent home for the child, and at that time, again, we look to our community for adoptive homes. We always try to place with relatives, but in many situations that isn't possible. So again, we look to our communities for these wonderful families. The parents oftentimes have significant needs if they're not able to provide for their children's safety. Those would include living in poverty, substance abuse, perhaps an extreme mental illness, domestic violence, for example. Also, the extreme emotional and behavioral needs of the child can contribute to the difficulty in providing for their safety. So again, as I said earlier, through my work at the Department of Human Services, I have become so appreciative of the providers in our community. While we assess at DHS the parent, child, and safety needs, we have to depend on our local providers to help meet those needs. So in Story County, I'm going to mention a few of these agencies, and I apologize if I forget any, but we're so lucky to have the following. We have Lutheran Services in Iowa, Youth and Shelter Services. We have the Assault Care Center Extending Shelter and Support, or ACCESS. We have Mid-Iowa Community Action, Ierley Ball Community Mental Health Services. So again, those are all of the wonderful services and supports that our families have. Oh, and I can't forget the awesome foster and adoptive parents who provide homes for kids that can't reside with their parents. So I just want to say a big thank you to all the agencies. I'm so happy that we are doing this community appreciation to show them our appreciation and thank them for all that they give to our kids and their families.
Well, thank you, Roxanne.
Yep.
And now, Roxanne, to get a closer look at some of the issues around foster care, let's hear one of the pre-recorded interviews we made before. This is an interview you did with two sisters who've been in foster care. Taking part with them in this interview, we'll also hear Terry Bailey, who's a foster parent and also the assistant coordinator for the AMP program, which is what you mentioned, Achieving Maximum Potential, which is a program especially for foster children within the Youth and Shelter Services, or YSS.
We are visiting with Kinley and Brinley, who are sisters. They have resided in foster care, and now they're in their adoptive home. And Brinley is going to speak because Kinley has laryngitis, so we'll be hearing mostly from Brinley. And then Terry is with us. Welcome, girls.
Hi.
This is Foster Care Month, and we wanted to visit with you a little bit about living in foster care and for any parents that are considering becoming foster parents, some of the qualities that is important to a foster child. So to get started, would you like to tell us a little bit about your situations such that you had to reside in foster care?
Well, when we were younger, our birth mom, she had an issue with men. She couldn't live without men, and our house was infested with cockroaches. And when I was younger, my birth dad had sexually abused me and three of my older sisters and a friend of ours, and which caused us to go into the system when we were about 8 and 9 years old.
And how many kids were there?
There were 5 of us. We have a brother, but he was sent in to the system at the age of 4 and adopted at 4.
So then 2 of you girls are together now. Has that always been the case?
Yes.
Were you ever all 4 or 5 together?
No.
So speaking of that, since you weren't able to be together, were you able to still see each other and have a relationship with your siblings?
Yes, we had a visit about once, twice a week, sometimes even 3.
Well, that's awesome.
And we were even able to see our birth mom sometimes until her rights got terminated, but we still got to see our siblings. It ended up going down once a month.
That's very good, because I don't think that always happens, so that's good. And I know you girls have been adopted. When did that happen?
On November 23rd, 2013.
And how's that going?
It's going pretty well.
Yes.
We're in a good family.
Kinley just gave a thumbs up, so that's her vote, too. Can you tell us some of the qualities that are very important when you're living in a foster home to make your world go okay?
A few things that are important is to treat the kids like you, like they actually belong in the family, and care for them, because then eventually they'll open up and tell you their story.
So is it important that they want to hear about your story and important for you to feel comfortable talking about your situation?
Yes. So you can actually understand if they're hurting, you'll understand the reasoning why they're hurting. Mm-hmm.
So if you're acting a little grumpy, it's important for them to know maybe what you'd been thinking that caused you to feel that way?
Yeah.
Yeah. How about, again, this is a community appreciation show, and we want our community to appreciate foster families, the situations that foster youth are in. So do you have any things to share about when you go to a new school, if you're in foster care, anything that's important to make you feel comfortable and part of the group?
When you transfer to a new school, making sure that the teachers are supportive of the kids and the students know that they're struggling.
So it's okay for your classmates to know a little bit about your situation so that they can be there for you and you can feel support from them?
Yes.
Yeah, good. Carrie, do you want to add anything to anything that we've been talking about?
Well, I was just thinking about the school situation. I know a lot of youth move several times from school to school. And if there are any youth listening to this, think about what it feels like to move to a brand new school. You have, no friends. You haven't made friends yet. You're at the lunch table and you have nobody to sit with. Understand that these youth are coming from a place where they've been living through trauma and they've lost pretty much everything important to them, their family, their friends, their community, and they need you to be the kind of person who has a smile on their face and welcomes them to a new school and helps them find their classes, helps them adjust to a whole new living situation. Because when you think about foster care, most of these youth have been taken very abruptly. All their belongings are in a garbage bag. They are moved sometimes they're taken from school, they're taken from their homes, and they're going into families that they don't know. They're strangers. So that's pretty traumatizing. So as a foster family, you also have to keep this in mind because you have youth who are coming to you with that deer in the headlights look because they're very afraid and they're very scared and they don't know what to expect. So they need your smiling face and your patience and your conversation and just their help to get adjusted back to life.
Thank you, Terry. That was very articulate. Another thing I thought about is foster parents are also can be licensed for adoptive parents. As Terry said, when a child is removed from the birth family, the goal is returning that child to their birth family, if at all possible. If it is not able to occur, then parental rights are terminated and the child becomes eligible for adoption. So that is why we license families for both foster care and adoption, because if a child is not able to return to the birth family, then would the family that the child is living with be considered for adoption?
Definitely. That would be first case scenario. I mean, best case scenario. You know, there's already love there. So that would be the best case scenario.
Well, I also can remember from my DHS days, Terry, earlier you said that you have a relationship with those birth parents, and that's awesome for the youth when they're in foster care. But then also if the birth parent realizes whatever is going on in their life is not going to be able to change to the degree that they will be able to parent their child, then if they know that the foster family would be available for adoption, it might be easier for the birth family sometimes to say, I can't do this. I mean, if they know that the child may come, so that co-parenting, you know, can end up being good for everyone.
Oh, definitely. In fact, that was my personal situation. The two young people that I adopted, their mother was, her liver was failing. She was an alcoholic. And she said to me, I can tell my children love you, and I can't think of anything better than for you to be their family. And that set up the whole situation for us to become a bigger part of that family and keep those kids in contact with their biological family.
And I think that's even important once youth are adopted, that they still have a relationship. Just because they weren't able to live with the birth parents, many times it's due to substance abuse or severe mental illnesses. And that doesn't mean that they don't love the child. They're just not able to meet the child's needs. So if they can continue to have a relationship, that's kind of a win-win for everybody.
Definitely. We had aunts and uncles that would come and visit on holidays. We would take summer vacations to aunts and uncles and cousins. And so it was nice to keep them connected.
Any words that you'd like to offer any families out there that are considering becoming a foster family?
Making sure that if you get another kid, making sure that the first kid that you get is original, like actually likes the other kid, mm-hmm. just in case if they end up having problems with that kid. And if they do, make sure they're on separate ends of the house.
So the youth that are already in the family should get a vote on whether the new child comes in, or because you all got to live together as brothers and sisters, right?
I've heard that. I've heard others say that is important. But I know your mother, and she does pay attention to what you youth are saying. So,
yes.
Well, I'd like to thank you for sharing your story with us today and letting us know what's important. So thank you, girls, and thank you, Terry. You're an awesome spokesperson.
That conversation with Kindley and Brindley makes the fourth interview we've had this month with children who have been or still are in foster care. And it's been noticeable how often the same issues kept coming up. Like that issue about changing schools or the possibility of being separated from one's siblings.
Yes, unfortunately, Kay, those two issues are common for foster children.
Yeah, and it was quite interesting. I cut this out of the recorded interview, but we asked, or Roxanne asked Kindley and Brindley what especially important things, you know, parents and adoptive foster parents should know. And they said, make sure they haven't got head lice before they go to school, before it spreads around the school. That was an issue for them.
So, right.
Was the most important thing, they thought.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we've been talking about two groups of disadvantaged people, those born with cognitive issues that make them eligible to participate in the Special Olympics, and also children who find themselves in the foster care system. We now turn to another disadvantaged group, the working class. Greta Anderson has a report from the Working Families Summit that took place this weekend. Welcome, Greta.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here. Yeah, I attended the Working Families Summit as a reporter, and they called it a summit because there's been a couple of conservative summits down in Des Moines, the Ag Summit, for instance. Mm-hmm. And it was a gathering of a lot of people. The they began with a panel of working Iowans, and one had been denied her rightful wages at an Outback restaurant in Coralville, Iowa. Another was a college graduate who had inordinate levels of student debt, and this really set the tone for the day. The rules have changed since when we were young people. In the words of keynote speaker Robert Reich, the rules have been rigged by those at the top. So, for instance, I learned in my breakout session that wage theft, such as that person experienced, is a $600 million problem in Iowa. And that if a business is found to have withheld wages from a person for no good reason, there's no penalty by the law. We also found that the law does not allow students to refinance their debt, their student debt, at a lower rate. So event promoters were happy with the attendance. There were around 600 people there, and it was a diverse group. The labor groups were present, of course. So was state NAACP and LULAC, the Latin American Association. There was certainly a strong effort to address the immigrant reform from a position of solidarity. If, for instance, if the huge workforce of undocumented labor is allowed to come out of the shadows, this can only have a good effect on wages overall. So there was really a very strong message of solidarity among working people. And in fact, one of the panel members, the one who experienced wage theft at Outback, was an immigrant from Africa. And then we heard from a Spanish-speaking organizer who helped her get her wages. So it was diverse. But trust me, this event would not have taken place with this level of attendance and this level of, actually, there were national groups represented, if it weren't for Iowa's first-in-the-nation status in relation to the upcoming caucuses and presidential campaign in 2016. Throughout the event, attendees were urged to ask candidates from both parties, you know, specific questions such as, you know, what do you think about the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, which is now being pushed by President Obama and opposed by many progressive groups? You know, what are you going to do about breaking up the banks and other monopolies? So the day was capped off by the keynote address by Robert Reich, former labor secretary under Bill Clinton. He had a very informative perspective on the erosion of conditions of the middle class, but also very charming and humorous delivery. I've prepared a sample of his message. So let's hear that now.
I could talk. I belong to the Fidel Castro School of Oratory, which means I could talk for 4.5 hours and you would miss dinner and I'd miss my plane. I'm just giving you examples of how the rules could be changed to favor the middle class, working class, and the poor. It's not hard. What's hard is the politics, which gets back to this meeting, which gets back to Iowa, which gets back to the questions you're going to ask Hillary Clinton and Bernie and anybody else. The biggest enemy we have is not the regressives. The biggest enemy we have is cynicism. You see, what's going on, and it's important that we squarely deal with this. It's not just cynicism. It's also the divide and conquer. Because you've got demagogues, starting with Fox News and hate radio, and right into a lot of the regressive precincts. And what they're doing is they're saying, your frustration, your anger, your cynicism, I understand it. You know why? It's because of them. And then they point the finger of blame at who? At the immigrants. Or the people of color, or the union members, or unions, or government itself. You see, it's all that venom and all that hate there. They're capitalizing on the frustration and anger that so many Americans right now have, and they're saying they're using the politics of resentment to divide us. So to take our economy back, to take our democracy back, what we've got to do is not only overcome the cynicism, but what we have to do is pull people together again. We have the numbers. We have the majority. We have the capacity. We've got to overcome their ability to sow cynicism and also hate and resentment. It's not going to be easy.
And that was Robert Reich speaking at the Working Families Summit this past Saturday at the Scheman Building in Ames. And if our listeners would like to hear more of Robert Reich, we are going to play the entire speech for Thursday's Heart of Iowa program at noon and 7 p.m. this week. That's Thursday. So stay tuned for that, and thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Greta. Thank you very much.
And this brings us to our final guest, Kelly Diekman, who is the Director of Housing and Planning for Ames. He is finishing up his second year in that role. At last week's City Council meeting, council members gave the go-ahead for the bidding process for developers to present plans to develop the lot on 6th Street, the one that's across from City Hall and adjacent to First Christian Church, as low-income housing. And low-income housing is something which many agree is much needed in this town. The city acquired this lot in July of last year and is planning to develop it as low-income housing. Welcome to Local Talk, Kelly.
Thank you.
Getting to this point has been a process. Can you tell us how the process began, please?
Certainly. The way we use our federal funds in Ames, we have to have an annual plan that we put out in advance of where we plan to spend our money. So last summer, when we adopted an annual action plan, we identified the opportunity to try and acquire some real estate or some property for affordable housing development. Just so happened that the lots across the street from City Hall happened to be for sale because ACPC had moved to their new home. And after they'd been for sale for a few months and no one else had purchased them, we thought this could be a good site for us to look at some infill affordable housing. And that really started off last summer. You may remember we tried to really quickly jump on an opportunity to get some state grants to help pay for that last August, but it was just a little bit too quick last summer to pull a real project together to be competitive on the state level. So although we tried in about 3 weeks to pull that together, it didn't happen. So then we went through the winter looking at what could we really put here and try and formulate a plan for council to prepare the response for proposals that we put out now this week.
Cool.
Now, I believe this was funded, at least in part, by a community development block grant, CDGB. Mm-hmm. And in the past, this grant has been used for things like improving curbs and sidewalks, right?
Yes.
So this development of low-income housing is a change, isn't it? And welcome one to many people. And I wonder, you know, if there's any process that led to this change.
I think what you have with CDBG, Community Development Block Grant Funds, it's a federal program that we get an entitlement based on our population annually. Mm-hmm. And within that program, you have a few different objectives that you can look at: neighborhood stabilization, some affordable housing provision. But what it really is an infrastructure, and I'm using air quotes, I'm on the radio, sorry, that a variety of type of infrastructure. It can be curb and gutter, sewer, something a neighborhood might need to be kind of rehabilitated. But there's also reinvestment in housing. You can do housing rehabilitation, and you can acquire property, or you can even acquire property for public facilities like a mm-hmm. park. Mm-hmm. So it's all kinds of stuff that's on the ground investments that you can make. The city has at times used funds to do different affordable housing projects, but they've been it's been a few years, and they've been frequently through state allocations of money, not using mm-hmm. our local money. So in this case, the city council said, again, last year when we were looking at their annual allocations, could we find some opportunity sites? Is there something we can do with the money that could move affordable housing ahead as a development option? Mm-hmm. And this is what we were able to find right now. So what we can fund is the purchase of land and getting a site ready for development, but we can't actually build the housing with that kind of money.
So that will be a private developer that will do that?
It'll be interesting to see what we get back for responses.
Right.
So we're offering incentives in terms of probably be willing to donate the land to a developer. We are probably willing to look at giving them property tax abatement to help them make the rents work a little bit better. But they may also have to look for other funding sources from either federal or state programs to close some of the construction cost gaps as well.
Mm-hmm. So will these be rental units or owner-occupied units?
They're targeted at rental units. That's something that we took to council last week. We want to be very clear what the purpose of the unit was, and it was a rental household is what we're targeting.
That's good.
Yeah, going back to the sort of criteria that you were developing for choosing a developer, mm-hmm. I see that one criterion is that the assisted units remain income restricted for longer than 20 years, it says. But this criterion only earns 10 points.
Mm.
What's to prevent the developer? And then, you know, there's all sorts of other things, like the experience they've had as a developer, the experience they've had at managing rental properties and so on, that get much more points. So this is only 10 points. They could still win if they've got like a zero on that. Hmm. So what's to prevent a developer from charging much higher rents after, say, 3 years?
So the way that is really a bonus. There's going to be a minimum term of 20 years for anybody. And then if you're willing to commit the property to additional restrictions past 20 years, that's how you earn those points.
So it's got to be low income for at least
That's at least the way this is written, years. So at least 20 years. And then and with CDBG, they don't define the duration of the affordability, so we have some control there. This 20 years is kind of a minimum expectation in affordable housing worlds. If they leverage other funds from a home program or they get low-income tax credits, they'll automatically have to extend these programs past 20 years because those programs have more restrictive rules than CDBG. So we put a starting point at 20 years, and then we'll see what they come back with to see how much longer it would be.
Now, I see one of the things was the site had to be rezoned to allow 10 units instead of 6 to be built. Mm-hmm. Has that happened, that rezoning, or is that still
Council
in the
work? Asked us to start the process for that. A zoning process is really kind of independent of us building affordable housing. It's about a 3-month process to kind of take a site and rezone it. The reason that is the area north of downtown is what we call a single-family conservation overlay. In the past, we had some poor infill examples where people tried to intensify their property with small apartment buildings or duplexes or triplexes. And it kind of tore up that single family neighborhood appeal that we had in Old Town and other parts of downtown. And so we created an overlay that just stopped allowing for assemblage of property and to build apartment buildings. So to really have a chance to get the attention of an affordable housing builder, you need to have more than 3 units really to get their attention. And we bought 3 lots. So what we're really asking for is to remove the restriction that lets us merge the property into one. Mm-hmm. And it has still the same density attributes, still has the same design requirements that would be permitted in other parts of the single family conservation overlay. But it will let us do what we're calling a townhome building type. Mm-hmm. It's not something you see a lot of in Ames. There's versions of it in Somerset, but we're not talking about Somerset here. Mm-hmm. We're trying to get a wholly kind of different approach to what a row home or a town home could be. So although this is affordable housing that we're going for, we're also seeing it in our department as an opportunity to look at infill housing and see if there's a design attribute to that that would be more sensitive to the surroundings.
Yeah, I noticed there was points given for things like, you know, varying roof lines and breaking up the mass of the building and so on in the design.
Yeah.
And also for things like green construction and so on. So that was very...
Right. So we kind of played off of if you go to the state for funding, you have a mandatory what they call Green Streets checklist. It's interesting to use the word street, but it's really green building. Mm-hmm. And it has a lot of range of points that you can get from site selection to building construction to energy efficiency. Well, we already know that we had a great site. I mean, you can't get a better site than a downtown site when you have transit access and a grocery store within a block. Parks within a couple of blocks. So we actually narrowed it down from what a state program would look like and said we wanted to look at energy efficiency to lower the operating costs, lower what a household has to pay out of their income for heating and cooling, and also that they have energy efficient appliances. So again, that's another way to look at the sustainability of what the rent levels will be for households.
Kelly, I see that most of the units will have at least 3 bedrooms, which make them sound suitable for families. But will there be any regulations that will prevent a group of students renting one of the units?
This was a big discussion point for council last week. Just by the nature of how CDBG defines where you can spend funds, in those regulations it does say a full-time student is not allowed to receive the benefit of use of CDBG. So it can't be student housing. We can't use our funds that way. And we'll have to work through how that's administered exactly with the final developer. So it is definitely targeted towards families. It can't be students that have assembled together to live.
How do they phrase that? Do they say limit the number of unrelated people that live there, or how do they do that?
It'll probably be through job and income verification. We have to do that for everybody because we're going to have income limits on the property. So it'll be looking at what your status is. Are you a student? Are you an employed individual?
So, in fact, I mean, I think it'd be a good thing. If 3 unrelated people who happen to be not students wanted to, you know, live together and want to, you know, incorporate, that would work, would it?
Potentially. CDBG doesn't, I believe, limit association by unrelated people. We define a family in Ames as 3 unrelated people or more if you are related, but it's possible that could work. Council definitely said they put in preferences for families. So if there was a waiting list, there will be some preferences. We would prioritize people through a waiting list, and we kind of said we have to work through those details a little bit more as we get towards the end of the process.
Going back to the design thing, I noticed that one criterion for design includes consideration of the principles for crime prevention through environmental design. Mm-hmm. Can you explain that?
That's interesting.
Yeah, our public safety department uses SEPTED for short, likes to review apartment projects or multifamily housing. They actually have a program where property managers and property owners can come to them to get their apartments certified through this process. And what it is, it's looking at trying to limit the opportunities for behavior where there's no visibility, where there's lack of light, mm-hmm. just environments that don't feel safe. Oh. So this should be pretty straightforward for us here. It's limiting vegetation that creates places where people can hide. It creates lighting so people feel comfortable walking in and out of entrances. It puts entrances on the street so you have eyes on the street. So you right. can, again, surveil areas and yeah. understand what's outside before you go outside. So it's a program that that the police department already administers in the community for multifamily housing.
On March the 15th, the council met with people who will be neighbors in this development. Three of the four neighbors who came to the meeting represented First Christian Church, mm-hmm. who will be adjacent to this property. They have concerns about parking access and safety. Now, they did write about this in the Tribune. It wasn't very clear what the problem was. So I called up the Reverend Mary Jane Button Harrison about these concerns. And she made it clear, and it's not absolutely clear until you know the site pretty well. There's two alleys, apparently. Mm-hmm. Made it clear the main concern is with the safety of the people exiting the parking lot of the new development, not going in. She even went so far as to say, you know, our parking lot is our parking lot, but I don't mind them driving through our parking lot when they're coming in. Mm-hmm. It's when they're coming out, depending on where you put the exit or the access. It's when they're coming out that they will, if they come through our parking lot, they will go against the flow of the traffic in our parking lot. So it's a safety concern. It's not that she's being possessive about her parking lot. So what do you have to say to that?
Yeah, it's a little bit unique. The public alley splits the church's parking lot in half. Mm-hmm. It's a one-way circulation. We're on 6th Street. You can come into the property and get to the alley. And her biggest concern is if people are already on the alley that they are trying to get to 6th Street because it's easier to get out to the main roads. And that's the opposite of the way that the parking lot is set up. And that's how it's built now. What we've said is when we get to the site design, we'll see what we can do to deter people from doing that.
And there is another place that the exit could be made, you said.
They would like us to look at what the opportunities are for maybe a driveway on the site itself, maybe parallel to the church's access. And we said that at this point, we weren't sure how that impacted how many homes could fit on the site. So we were saying we'll look at that again when we see a proposal, and we won't forget about the access issue.
Okay, well, thank you. We're sort of running out of time, I see. But I noticed you've got a public hearing coming up. Would you like to tell people about that when they can put their input in on this issue?
Really, what happened is we're going to be getting proposals back. It's going to be at the end of the summer when we'll be putting all the proposals out after they've been scored by a committee and then make a recommendation to the council, and then people will be able to make comments.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Kelly Diekman, telling us about this. That's it for Local Talk. We've been your hosts for today, Kay Partick and Roxanne Thompson, and we've been taking a look at the concerns of children and working families.
Today, a special guest has been Greta Anderson, who's more commonly in the role of host for this show. Other guests were Kelly Diekman, Director of Housing and Planning for the City of Ames, and Tim Wilson, Statewide Administrator of the Lions Club. Guests in the recorded interview were Terry Bailey, a foster parent and assistant coordinator of the AMP program for YSS, and also Kinley and Brinley, two sisters, have been in foster care.
Local Talk was engineered today by Rick Morrison. Our theme song is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. Or stop by the studio. We'd love to see you. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. And check us out on Facebook. You can listen to this show and all our past local talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. You can find today's show on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, is able to post it.
KHOI is now streaming live online at khoifm.org, where you can also find archives of KHOI's shows. Please remember that you, as listener, are the most important part of Local Talk. Your participation as an audience and your generous donations help make it all possible. And now that we've just finished our pledge drive, I want to say a thanks to everyone who has made a new pledge. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.